Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most of us have been taking our privacy for granted. Most of us have adopted modern technology and welcomed it into our lives. We have cell phones, use computers, our cars are decked out with GPS navigation. We save money by using frequent shopper cards. Many have digital assistants to whom they make requests throughout the day. You know, hey, Alexa, Google, Siri, do this, do that. We have begun hooking up to the Internet of Things. We have video doorbells so we can see who's at the door. We use our phones to close our garage doors or change the thermostat, even warm up or cool down our cars before we get in. Great, huh? A perfect 10 for convenience, but where does that put us on the privacy scale? And we're just scratching the surface here. That's what we're going to examine this hour, because there is a trade-off, and that trade-off may provide reason for concern as the digital bits and bytes we leave as breadcrumbs are collected, aggregated, analyzed, and used to create an astoundingly accurate profile, one that is as revealing about our pasts as it is predictive of our future behavior. Joining us for the hour is Barry Friedman. He's the director of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law and the author of Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission. And that's the other thing that we're talking about today. In fact, that's most of what we're talking about today. He joins us via Skype. Thank you for being here.
Hi, good to be here, Mike.
Thank you. We invited someone from the TSA and Customs and Border Control and other law enforcement organizations to be part of this discussion, but they could not or would not provide a guest. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So, with the proliferation of technology into our lives, if after listening to this hour anyone has any reservations about how technological convenience impacts privacy or how law enforcement is using some of these tools, is it too late for them to do anything about it?
No, not at all. I think just the opposite, which is there has now reached enough attention to these issues in the mind of the public that it is the time to do something about it. I'll give you two metaphors. So sometimes we talk about the horses or the cows being out of the barn, and sometimes I've even heard people talk about the toothpaste being out of the tube. Mm-hmm. It's harder to get the toothpaste back in the tube than it is the horses and cows back in the barn, and I think it's the latter situation, which is if we all focus now, we can get the kind of legislation and controls we need on some of these technologies.
So all these digital bits and bytes that we are leaving behind through our personal use of technology and the technology that law enforcement is beginning to adopt on a national and even a local level are capturing things about us that perhaps we are completely unaware and would be shocked to find out and maybe worried to find out. And in fact, your book is called Unwarranted, Policing Without Permission. So we're all caught up in this digital dragnet, right? Like it or not.
Yes. I mean, it's almost impossible now to go off the grid and not leave these little breadcrumbs. I like the analogy. So, you know, your cell phone is pinging cell towers, which law enforcement can then subpoena. Your car is driving around the streets and there are license platers readers that are recording where it has gone. There are concerns about some jurisdictions starting to use facial recognition. So every time you pass a CCTV camera, and there are a lot more of those out there than you might realize, there are red light cameras. It's very impossible to move around the world right now and not have the ability to know where you've been.
And this is what we did shows years ago on big data, and this is what big data has become in part. When police and other law enforcement run across information that we are leaving behind about people who are not doing anything wrong or they're capturing our image on one of these cameras that you're talking about, are these details, these photographs, et cetera, are they discarded or do they exist in perpetuity?
That's a terrific question, and I actually want to indicate that there may be two separate things for us to talk about. So one of them is, you know, is it everybody or is it just the bad guys?
Yeah.
And then the other is the information being kept? So I'm going to go to the first one first, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So, you know, a lot of times people think that the thing law enforcement should be doing is just going after the bad guys. But if you think about it and you look at the world in which you live, the way that we're keeping the country, the city, the state safe increasingly is by surveillance of everyone. And I'll give you a perfect example. Think about airport security. Airport security doesn't just target the people that the government thinks might be carrying something dangerous onto a plane. It targets everybody that's getting on a plane. And that's the model that's starting to be used. And it's not a bad model in some ways. In fact, in some ways, it avoids a lot of discrimination and is a better way of keeping us safe. But because of that, it leads to your second point, which is now they're collecting information on all of us all of the time. And the question becomes, what happens with that information?
And I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, that with the advent of supercomputers and now quantum computers on the horizon, they can actually use this information. Before, they would have been overwhelmed by this, and we would have been lost in a stack of digital bits and bytes that they could never have processed. Now they can, right?
Yes and no. So on the yes side of that, it is certainly true that there's this huge amount of information that can be processed. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, that is the hope of all of this, which is that there's this enormous amount of information that lets artificial intelligence run that, you know, does a lot of amazing things that we will appreciate in our lives. Yeah. The danger, which actually I think they could do without some of the supercomputing that they have now, is just that they're aggregating information about individuals. So think about your cell phone. Basically, what you're doing is you're carrying around a GPS tracker with you all the time. And the cell phone companies are holding on to that information. Now, if somebody in the government gets curious, they issue a subpoena or an order to the cell phone company and says, you know, I'd really like to know where Mike's been for the last 2 days or week or month or year. And that it is possible to stitch together your life from all these different sources. Sure. And that's the thing we should be worried about.
Why do the cell phone companies keep that information? I mean, I understand in the days when we paid for long distance that they would want to know when you made a phone call and to where, so they could bill you for it. Well, now they don't. So why do they keep long distance records? Why do they keep records of what towers our cell phone has pinged?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And, you know, part of the answer is we've just become data hoarders. I mean, think about your email. I'm guessing that, you know, 10 years ago, even you didn't save all of your emails. And now you've got this monstrous number of emails that you've just put somewhere in case you need them someday. So, you know, I think that everybody thinks that way. It's also that this data is valuable to mine. I mean, they can sell it. They can use it to figure out how to improve their businesses. But that does come with a very serious cost. And I believe that one of the answers here, particularly around, for example, license plate readers, which we just issued a report on, is that we can't live with that kind of retention, that even if it makes sense to get the information initially, it's got to be disposed of, that the danger is creating these warehouses of data.
Right. Let's talk about that, because there are going to be people listening who will say, let's use the airport example that's now proliferating into other areas of our lives where we're all under constant surveillance, and the idea is to keep us safe from the bad guys. And there will be people listening who say, well, I don't care. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I don't care if you know I went to the grocery store today at 2 o'clock and then went to the shoe store at 2:15 and then went to see my grandmother at 2. I don't care. Just keep me safe. So are they being naive or are they right?
Once again, two separate questions. First is, you know, is it keeping you safe? Well, that's an assertion that doesn't have a lot of evidence behind it. And my dear friends in law enforcement, and I have many, will often, you know, point to the one case they had. But we at the Policing Project think that the goal is to think about cost-benefit analysis and ask, okay, you had one case, but could you have cracked that one case another way? What were the costs of retaining all of this data? So we do have to think, is it really effective to collect all this data? As for the, you know, I don't have anything to hide, because people say that to me all the time. And I have an answer, which is super. Just send over to me the login for your email and your password. Thanks. Because I don't have anything to hide either, but that doesn't mean that I don't send emails that are embarrassing, that are personal, that are intimate. I don't want people to read my correspondence with my daughter or my son or my wife. And none of us want to be picked through like that. And that's
there
really
are people doing that if you're not a criminal suspect?
Well, so it depends on what the situation is. I mean, first, the important point is there's the capability to do that without any question. And so you don't know at any moment if it's happening or if it's not. Now, on one end of the spectrum, the kind of ugly end of the spectrum, you know, you always hear these incidents of some rogue law enforcement officer that decided to figure out what some spouse was doing on Thursday. And so things like that do happen. I don't think that's the norm, but we ought to be concerned about the norm, which is just the aggregation of information about us that can be acquired at a moment's notice, and think about whether we really want that to be the state of affairs.
Your work around digital privacy revolves around policing, and police here in Charlotte and around the country have spent billions of dollars to take advantage of all this new technology, which we hope is being used exclusively in the service of catching the bad guys. But police don't have the best reputation in certain communities, and there's a lack of trust among certain communities. Does this use of what our devices are telling them about who we are, where we go, what we do, what we're interested in, is this the kind of thing, the possession of this information, the kind of thing that builds trust?
I think it creates concern in an environment that already is not trustful. So to be clear, the Policing Project, which works to bring this sort of permission or democratic accountability to the use of all of these technologies, we work with everyone in the space, advocates, activists, lots of policing agencies. And in fairness to those agencies, what they tell us is, look, we're getting bombarded by tech. We got a new vendor knocking at our door every minute. And if you're the police and you want to keep the community safe, what you don't want to have happen is somebody asking a question after the fact, why didn't you? Why didn't you get this surveillance technique? Why weren't you using it? But on the other hand, in communities that are concerned about the police, there's huge suspicion about these tools. There's an answer, Mike. And the answer isn't to say, well, we're just not going to use these technologies to keep us safe, though some might be particularly problematic, like facial recognition. The answer is we're going to use them in a responsible way. And that is what we have not done as a society. We've just, it's the Wild West out there. We've just acquired it and used it and not thought about the rules.
We're going to talk a lot about facial recognition because it's coming to the Charlotte Airport sometime next year. We'll talk about that in a little while here. But in earlier times, when police wanted to surveil you, particularly the use of your telephone, they would wiretap you or plant a bug in your office, and they would do that after having gotten a court order or a warrant. Is the same true today when they can buy information from enormous outside companies that have been capturing big data from all of us?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So, I love these in days of old stories, and I'm going to one up you on days of old.
Okay.
So, in days of old, as even the Supreme Court has recognized, they maybe put a bug into your house with a warrant allowing them to do that, though that was complicated. And beyond that, they had to, try to follow you around. We've all seen the movies. It's quaint. But that was hard to do. Now it's super easy to get all this information. And you're right. And since the police don't even have to collect it, they just have to buy it because there are companies out there collecting information on you and putting it together in ways that would, to be blunt, freak you out. There are companies that produce license plate readers that are cameras that record license plate numbers as they go by. And I had even thought until a while ago that it was just the police using these to capture license plate. But it turns out that there are repo trucks that are running around sucking up as many license plate numbers as they can, because when a bank then calls and says, we want your car, it's great to have this huge database of where all the cars have been. And I learned this week that in Manhattan, over a 30-day period, those trucks picked up 7 million license plate reads.
Wow. We have to take a break. I have to stop you there. Barry Friedman's our guest with the Policing Project. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Barry Friedman. He's the director of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law and the author of Unwarranted: Policing Without Permission. We're talking about the digital bits and bytes that we leave behind by using technology, modern technology, and also about how modern technology is being used by law enforcement to catch the bad guys. But in reality, we are all caught up in this dragnet. We were talking just before the break, Mary, about the fact that in the old days, if they wanted to wiretap your phone, they got a warrant. Now they can do it almost without warrant. They can certainly find out information about you without a warrant because they can buy this information from these big data companies all over the place. Can we buy this information? I know you can, if you're a Google person, you can go on Google and look at what Google has stored about you, but they're just one of a lot of entities that collect this info. Can we see this info about ourselves?
So, you know, I don't know the specifics of the answer to that question other than the fact that there are some vendors that, you know, say they're only selling to law enforcement, but there are plenty of other vendors that are obviously selling information to, you know, credit lenders, banks, whatnot.
Right.
So I think generally speaking, the information's widely available. I want to make a point that I often make, and I think it's important, which is there's a need to distinguish, though, between law enforcement and these other entities. So we do have plenty of reasons we've learned to worry about Facebook or Google or whatnot, particularly around politics and elections. But in general, Google and Facebook and these other companies are not going to knock on your door in the early hours of the morning and want to take you away. The government might, and that is an important distinction.
There was an article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in December of last year called The Watchers, and it illustrated how ICE and other law enforcement agencies are surveilling, tracking, arresting undocumented immigrants in the Pacific Northwest with what the authors described as, quote, startling precision. They were using some of the things that we've already talked about, traffic cameras that photographed license plates and then cross-checked them in a computer thousands of times per minute. They were using facial recognition software on pictures of individuals that they captured through cameras and through Facebook posts. And by running them against driver's license photos, they were combing social media for posts that showed them family relationships and friendships and whereabouts, and then using algorithms to determine if those individuals were likely to become positively contributing members of society or likely to commit criminal acts. It's astounding. If they're doing this in efforts to identify or locate or deport individuals, what is the likelihood it's being used on all of us at any time for any reason?
Well, there are. It is at some level, and we should not be naive about this. I mean, I'm sure that many of your listeners watched the very frightening movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise years ago, where the government had this way of identifying what it called pre-crime, which is, you know, we're going to find out ahead of time whether a homicide is going to occur, and we're going to go snap those people out of society. Well, there are vendors now that have products so that if the police have been called to an address, it gives them a readout on where they're going. You know, who lives there? Do they have any prior offenses? Does anyone own a gun? And again, you might think this is great. The police should have this information. But first, it's wholly unregulated, and there are reasons to worry. It implicates many of our constitutional rights. All the gun owners out there ought to know that, you know, we know where you are. And the other is the fact that they make mistakes. So there are errors in the data, and police are overly alerted, and they go in overly prepared, and then tragic things happen.
Does this activity, the collection of all this information that I just referred to, does it require any permission from any higher entity, or are the police and law enforcement officers free to use this at will?
There's nuance to an answer to that question, but basically let's just go with the stark answer. No, there's not protection. That's why I wrote the book. That's why we started the policing project. We're emphatically not against public safety. I always point out that I have young kids and want to be as safe as anybody, but there need to be controls on the way we use the technologies and the information, and we're living in pretty much of a vacuum.
That New York Times article that I just referenced goes on to say that, quote, for decades, the overriding objective of American business and government has been to remove friction from the tracking system by linking networks, by speeding connections, by eliminating barriers. But friction, they say, is the only thing that has ever made privacy, let alone obscurity, possible. If there's no friction, if we can all be profiled instantly and intimately, then there's nothing to stop any of our neighbors from being targeted. Nothing except our own priorities. How worried should we be about this? Not only about the fact that it's being done, about the mistakes that are being made, but also just the fact that it's just a terrible invasion.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I treasure in life, I've lived in small towns and I've lived, obviously live in Manhattan now, is being able to just walk out on the street and have nobody know who I am and to go about doing whatever I want to do during the day. Nothing very interesting, frankly, but I like the privacy of it. And what's happened is that we're living in a world in which that is sweeping away. So, think about facial recognition outside the law enforcement context. One of the things everybody's all excited about this has been discussed in many places, is you go to the supermarket, instantly upon entering, the supermarket knows you're there and who you are. It very helpfully recommends that you put into your basket some things that you pick up regularly. Maybe somebody comes out. This is it was a very influential book that talked about this possibility. Somebody comes out of the wine department and, you know, offers you a special on your favorite brand. The question is, do you want to live in that world? And some people think, yeah, that might be great to live in that world. It's really exciting. So Kai-Fu Lee wrote a book called AI Superpowers, in which he talked about these possibilities. But me, you know, my skin kind of crawls. I mean, I'll ask somebody if I want the wine that I like. And I'd rather not really have anybody know I'm there.
Yeah, our cell phones are allowing advertisers to geo-target us. So if we go to a pet store, pet food store, there may be a competing pet food store that would like to have our business, and they are advertising to people who go to the other pet food store to encourage you to come. You'll go into the other pet food store, and when you come out on your phone will be this ad for another pet food store, because they've digitally tracked you, and that's, maybe there's a benefit to that. I don't know. Sometimes, I know this is a case with me, I'll go someplace, and as soon as I leave, I'll get a little message on my phone saying, you were just at X shopping center. Did you enjoy your experience there? And they want you to rate it. Well, that means if I rate it, I'm telling everybody where I was. I mean, why would I want to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you do.
Okay.
And I don't think most people want to. But you've just described this bizarre world that we've entered into where, because we can do it, we do, and maybe people think we should. And look, advertisers and companies, they love this information. I mean, you have to understand, and this is what's driven us to this, is that artificial intelligence, which does, you know, many amazing things and will do many more amazing things in our lives, lives and breathes on data, on this kind of information. It doesn't work unless it has just millions and billions of pieces of information so that it can kind of predict and anticipate what people want. But what that means is that there's, you know, billions of pieces of information about you floating around.
Barry Friedman is the director of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law and the author of Unwarranted Policing Without Permission. There are these companies that we've been referring to, major companies, big companies that collect and analyze and keep all this information. Thomson Reuters among them, LexisNexis, which I believe NPR has used, and we use it for research. They're probably the most well-known among these companies that have been collecting and compiling and aggregating data and making associations among data points and then selling that information to governments and to law enforcement and to business. And none of us, the owners of this information about ourselves, none of us are aware of this. Are these companies regulated in any way?
I mean, states have privacy laws, some states, but by and large, again, the answer is no. This is all what people talk – I mean, a lot of this is what people talk about is open source information. It's out there about you, and so they acquire it, and the service they're providing is to aggregate it. I'll tell you an interesting story since you mentioned Thomson Reuters. So I was just at the International Association of Chiefs of Police annual meeting, and there's this huge exhibition floor, and there are a lot of folks selling weapons and uniforms and the things you'd sort of expect, but sort of half of the exhibition floor is tech companies, and there's this enormous, and you can kind of tell how big a company is and how prominent by how large its space is on the floor, and there was this enormous Thomson Reuters booth, and I was caught off guard at first because I'm a law professor, and Thomson Reuters was, you know, what we use for basic legal research, pretty sleepy company. But there's this whole new product line, which is gathering up information on you and making it available to law enforcement, that is a big moneymaker for them. And that's where we should all be concerned and where we do need regulation.
You've been calling for more regulation, and you're one of the original board members of something called the Axon AI, Artificial Intelligence and Policing Technology Ethics Board. And I know that you focused at one point on automated license plate readers, which are evidently everywhere. Is that all you focused on? And why did you focus on license plate readers?
So we are a board that's been up and running for about a couple of years. A number of companies have tried to have these ethics boards. And because, by the way, Mike, in the absence of any regulation, the companies themselves have said, whoa, we better get on top of this. Google put one together, which collapsed. But Axon, which is the largest manufacturer of body cameras for police and tasers, put a board together, which has worked extremely well. And we've put out two reports so far, two fat reports, one on facial recognition on body cameras and the other on license plate readers. We put out reports when the company wants to go into a certain space and wants its view. And the license plate reader story is interesting. So license plate readers pop onto the scene, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe less. And they're sold to police departments as a way to find stolen cars. Stolen car drives by you, the license plate reader pings at you, the cop stops the car. They turn out to be only so effective for that, but they can be used for lots of other things, one of which is fines and fees, traffic enforcement, nabbing people that haven't paid their parking tickets. And so all of a sudden, very lucrative for municipalities to get license plate readers, slap them on cop cars, catch, you know, traffic evaders, and make some money. But what Axon's doing, and it's fascinating, is we don't need those. Those units were like $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. We don't need those anymore. Axon's just going to use an AI algorithm and run it on the regular dash cam that cop cars have already in them. And so we're going to exponentially increase the amount of these cameras that are recording license plate reads and knowing where we're going all day long. And Axon wanted our views about what to do about that.
I'm trying to think what the question should be here, given what you just said.
I'll give you an answer. So, I mean, okay. Axon has critics out there in the world. I think anybody who sells products to the police get criticized. But I'm going to give them a shout out here, because the first time that their CEO said to me, we're going to make license plate readers cheap and pervasive, I was like, boy, that's no good. People are going to be unhappy about that. There are racial justice issues. There are privacy issues. And the company's been very creative. We say this in our report, in thinking about controls. And what our report says is, we don't like the way the world's going, but we do admire Axon's thought about putting these controls on their license plate readers, and we're only going to give a thumbs up if the controls are there. And I'll give you an example of one, okay, because it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So license plate readers are on cop cars. Cop cars tend to be in neighborhoods that are, you know, more crime-ridden, and those unfortunately tend to be poorer neighborhoods and often communities of color. So what happens is that there's over-enforcement in these communities, often communities of color, and we should be worried about that, but how do you know? Well, one thing you can do is that the license plate reader, all that data can be aggregated to create a heat map. So you could see after the fact where the license plate readers are being used. And that's the kind of control that ought to be on there, so that everybody in Charlotte, for example, should know how the license plate readers are being used in Charlotte. Are they being used fairly? What offenses are they being used for? Are they being used to capture groups of people that are racially disparate? And it's that kind of control that we need. And in my ideal world, that control would be coming not from the companies, but from your local, you know, from the city council or the state legislature. That's what we need.
So historically, when a cop pulled you over for speeding, they've always been able to call into a dispatch and check out your license and registration against the database, and also maybe certainly your license plate number, et cetera. How is this different from just calling into dispatch versus having this come in at a, is it just speed? Is it the ubiquity of it? Is that the difference?
You know, in a case about cell phone tracking, the Chief Justice and cell phone privacy, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you know, the government said, this is just like getting an address book out of somebody's pocket. And he said, you know, that's true, but it's kind of like the difference between riding on a horseback somewhere and sending a rocket to the moon. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you know, you could be called into dispatch, but now what happens is that for these license plate readers can cover 3-4 lanes of traffic, forward and backward, sucking in the license plates of everybody they pass and running those checks while the car is driving down the road, and then pinging the cop car if there's any individual of interest for anything.
So even if you've turned off your cell phone and it's no longer pinging the tower, and you think that you are on your own on the highway of life, these cameras are reading your license plate, so they know where you are pretty much in real time if they're interested in finding you. I would think they're only interested in finding you if you're a bad guy or a potential bad guy. So what's wrong with that?
Yeah. So yet again, you know, what's a bad guy? So let's say that, you know, you didn't pay a couple traffic tickets, which may make you a bad guy. You know, everybody can have their own definition of bad guy. Maybe everybody's really good at getting their traffic tickets paid all the time, or their parking tickets or whatnot. Depending upon the settings on that license plate reader, the cop may be pinged for that. And that's what I meant about fines and fees enforcement, which is some jurisdictions are using them for exactly that because it is lucrative. And in fact, there's one company out there, it's called Vigilant, it was purchased by Motorola, that has this deal where they, you know, they take your credit card right there and 25% of that will go back to the company, the private company. So the cop is basically doing a, you know, three parts for us, one part for you, with the private company stopping your car there.
Mm. Most of us have driver's licenses for which we have to submit to having our picture taken. And since we also give over financial information every time to the government, every year at tax time, and since we have credit cards and bank accounts, since we pay utility bills that attach our names and addresses together, do we really have to worry about all this other information that we're freely giving up by using cell phones, social media, computers, and the like, when anybody who is interested in this data, either these companies or the government, already knows everything about us?
Well, I mean, there's two points there. One is they're helping the government know more. So, you know, when I was writing my book and looking at some of the enforcement that came into place after 9/11.
No, I got 30 seconds. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, where they're just capturing huge amounts of this information and then just selling it to the government. So, yes, they know where you're going, but they're also selling it to the government. And they both need to be regulated.
When we come back, I'm going to talk about facial recognition, because that's a big deal. And you just wrote an article in the New York Times about this. So we'll talk about that with Barry Friedman, the director of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law and the author of Unwarranted Policing Without Permission, when Charlotte Talks continues on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Barry Friedman, director of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law, the author of Unwarranted Policing Without Permission. And we're talking about how data and the bits and bytes that we leave behind in the normal course of our life, when combined with other data collection apparatus used by law enforcement, is leading a highly detailed picture, not only of what we're doing right now and what we did yesterday and the day before that and the week and the month before that, but how we're likely to act in the future. And one of the emerging tools in this was the stuff of television shows and movies not too long ago, and now it's real, and that's facial recognition. It's all over big cities where cameras, traffic cameras, street-side cameras, security cameras are watching us and analyzing our facial structure and identifying who we are, because they have a database full of pictures from driver's licenses and sometimes social media that they can know our names with and attach these through algorithms to figure out who we are and where we are. So here in Charlotte, we are about to adopt a technology that has already been in use in some cities, facial recognition at the airport. It should be coming online sometime next year. At the gates for these departing international flights and at incoming customs stations, cameras will take pictures of travelers, download them to a computer system, compare them to electronically to photos already in a federal database, allowing officials to verify who we are. Now, at first, people will be able to opt out of this, but who knows how long that will last. Should we be concerned about this facial recognition technology? What's wrong with it?
Well, it is in many ways one of the most concerning technologies out there, if not the most, though there are lots of other biometric technologies that are coming down the pike. And the reason that it's concerning is because it's real hard to go down the street and hide your face. And if you have watched any of the protests in Hong Kong, you will see that, you know, people have been making every effort to hide their faces because China's got facial recognition cameras everywhere. And they use them for real-time surveillance. So they are watching where you're going and what you're doing and what you're purchasing to make sure that you're behaving properly. And that is not a world any of us want to live in. And so the question is there a responsible way to use this technology, or do we have to get rid of it? And there are lots of people calling for a ban.
San Francisco did ban it. They became the first city in the U.S. to ban the use of facial recognition outside of their airport, which they don't really have control over with the TSA. But they say that facial surveillance technology is incompatible with a healthy democracy. Do you agree with that, or do you agree with that only with the way it's being used now? Because I know that you have proposed some changes on how it might be used better in an article you wrote for the New York Times.
Right. So my own view and that of my co-author, Andrew Ferguson, at the University of the District of Columbia, and our perspective here at the Policing Project is it's just hasty to be completely for or completely against. You have to think through what are called use cases. How will it be used? So I'll give you an example. You know, when you say we should ban facial recognition technology completely, I have two questions for San Francisco. First, can people use the iPhone 10 to open their phones, or does that violate the ban? And second,
you mean facial recognition to open the iPhone?
Sorry. No, facial recognition. Okay. And then the other is, you know, what about if you've got a dead body and you don't know who it is? Does the ban encompass using facial recognition to identify that body? Now, those seem to be use cases to me that are sensible. And the question ought to be, can we get the sense out of it while, you know, addressing the danger? Now, if we can't, then maybe you ban the technology. Maybe it's that harmful. And there are, in fact, you know, racial disparity concerns around facial recognition. But if you can fix those problems, then again, you try to squeeze the good out of it and prohibit the ban, the bad.
So as I mentioned earlier, that we invited some people on from law enforcement and from ICE to join us, and they couldn't provide a guest. But they did provide a statement about what's about to happen at Charlotte Douglas International Airport with regard to facial recognition. Customs and Border Protection, they say, is working closely with our stakeholders in Charlotte for the future implementation of facial recognition at the Charlotte Airport. No timeline. All photos of U.S. citizens, they say, are deleted within 12 hours of identity verification. Photos of in-scope travelers, I don't know what that means, may be retained for up to 14 days. In-scope travelers are any aliens that are not exempt from a requirement to provide biometric identifiers. The most accurate algorithm can identify matches with only a 0.2% error rate, they say. Should we believe this?
I was just on a hastily put together ad hoc panel with the commissioner of Customs and Border Patrol, and he was saying the same thing about the accuracy rate. And the answer is, I don't know. What I do know, and so I'd be inclined, you know, I'm skeptical, to be honest, is that we just had Brad Smith, the president from Microsoft, here with us, talking about the fact that this facial recognition technology just does not work as well for darker-skinned folks and for women, frankly, as opposed to men. There are lots of reasons for that I can explain. But so I want to know how, you know, Customs and Border Patrol has conquered problems that some of the leading tech companies haven't. Now, there may be an answer, in fairness, which is facial recognition works a lot better if you can get a super clear image of a person and match it against a super clear image. And if that's what's going on, then, you know, maybe they're doing that well just for that limited pool.
Why doesn't it work as well on darker skinned people and women?
Yeah, so there are two answers to this. One is because what makes it work well, like with all artificial intelligence, is the training pool, how many pieces of data it has to test itself against. And it's just a fact that the training pool of photos that it has that have been used are not as representative of those groups. Now, why that is partly representation in society. But the second reason is these tech companies, if you look at their staff, are themselves not representative of society in these ways. And there's a real concern that because of that, the products have been developed in ways that just are insufficiently attentive to things we might care about like that.
This article that you wrote in the New York Times, in case people want to look it up, Barry Friedman, is called Here's a Way Forward on Facial Recognition. The police should be able to use it, but in a very limited way. And you say we should ban face surveillance the use of facial recognition in real time or from stored footage to track people as they pass by public or private surveillance cameras, allowing their whereabouts to be traced. On the other hand, you say, we should allow face identification, again, with strict rules, so police can use facial recognition technology to identify a criminal suspect caught on camera. How do those two recommendations peacefully coexist?
So it has to do with the infrastructure that's being used. So there are cameras out there in the world, and they catch people on subway platforms and train platforms and out on the street, and sometimes they catch bad things happening. People also carry around iPhones, and sometimes they snap images of bad things happening. And then when you've got that, the question is, you know, can you find out who was the bad actor? Suppose it was somebody who knifed somebody. Well, in the old days, what they would do is either show people the photograph or try to go to mugshot databases and compare it, and it was incredibly laborious and often almost impossible, except in the most serious of crimes. Now we have the capacity to just take that image and run it against zillions of photographs. And so that's face identification. That's very different than saying that those cameras everywhere are running facial recognition all the time in identifying everybody that goes by, and then even worse, storing that information. That's a big step past what we've said might be okay.
One of these databases run by Thomson Reuters is called CLEAR, which is an acronym for Consolidated Lead Evaluation and Reporting, and it's comprised of personal information that they gather from credit agencies, cell phone registries, social media posts, property records, utility accounts, phishing licenses, internet chat rooms, bankruptcy filings, all fused and vetted by an algorithm to form what the New York Times describes as an ever-evolving 360-degree view of our lives. That's just one data collection service. There are many, many others, and there's no way for any of us to avoid this. The European Union has taken a much tougher stand on privacy than we have in this country. Has that made their citizens less vulnerable to what could happen with this kind of information being out there, or are they just as exposed because of the other breadcrumbs they leave behind?
Well, so I'm not nearly an expert on the regulatory system in Europe, which is very complicated, but I can say a couple of things about it. First is, you know, they've focused a lot on the private industry side of this story and not so much on the law enforcement side of the story, and I think that's just a disastrous mistake. The other is, but they have focused on privacy, and we simply have not. We have just been so go, go, go around the technology that we have failed to think about the dangers that are ahead of us, and that's a huge mistake.
I know your focus professionally is on police, and there are concerns, obviously, about how police use this information and how they gain access to this information without a warrant in some cases, but also businesses are using this information, and people maybe don't know this, but you may apply for a loan and you get turned down. And it's not because of really anything in your credit record. It's associated information an algorithm uses to decide that maybe you shop in the same stores that people who default on their payments shop in. Therefore, you're not a good credit risk, even though you are, and you're denied a loan. Is there any recourse to this?
Yeah, so you make a terrific point, Mike, which is that increasingly the public-private line is getting blurred. They're partners together, and we have to think about it as a partnership. And the answer, again, is just regulation. There is a vacuum, and it is a vacuum that is time to fill. While I've been talking to you, my Twitter feed's been going mad about that op-ed, and people have strong views about this. And I'm Barry Friedman One, by the way, if people want to check. But the truth of the matter is, we all have to join together and decide that we're going to regulate. And it is going to be a hard fight because these companies making tons of money off of this are going to pour an enormous amount of that money into legislative efforts to keep the business going. The juice is going to be in the system. And so people need to be aware of what's happening and speak up about it. And by the way, you just made a terrific point, which is this is sort of like I don't have anything to hide. Until you go to the bank and it turns out they know all kinds of stuff about you that may bear upon your ability to get a loan.
Yeah. Let's bring this down to the ordinary person's level, as opposed to a person who may be a criminal or involved in criminal activities. And most people would say, well, the police should get their information and know where they are and what they're up to, because that's keeping us all safe. But a lot of us are just innocent people out there using this technology and blithely unaware of how it can impact them. Digital assistants like Amazon's Alexa and Siri and Google, they listen to us so that they can perform searches and other services that allegedly make our lives easier. And we assume that they're listening only after we say, hey, Alexa, or hey, Google, or Siri. Is that an accurate assumption, or are they listening all the time? And is it just a machine listening, or are there human beings listening? Are they recording this for analysis, data analysis later, so they can make their services better, so they're overhearing conversations that we'd rather not have them overhear? What about that?
So all of the above.
Great.
You know, the Policing Project has started to do privacy audits of some of these companies. We've been invited and asked to do them. We published a public report on one of the companies, ShotSpotter, which is gunshot detection. And ShotSpotter has used its technology extremely responsibly, but there was concern that these sensors out on the streets to detect gunshots were picking up voices. And so, you know, we went in and looked and made a number of recommendations to them, and they have made changes to their product. And we recommend that other tech companies go through these kinds of privacy audits because, you know, yes, of course, Alexa is listening before you say Alexa. Otherwise, how does Alexa know that you want her? And once you've pinged Alexa, that information gets recorded somewhere. And it doesn't mean somebody's in real time sitting and listening. How could they be possibly listening to everybody? But it's available, and sometimes it's stored. And so Every question you just asked needs to be asked and needs to be regulated.
The Fourth Amendment prevents law enforcement from unjustifiably searching a home. But there's something called the third-party doctrine that allows police to access information voluntarily shared with a third party, like a bank or a phone company or Alexa. Do you think people are aware of this? Has it been used against people?
I mean, it's used against everybody all the time. In the sense that the government goes to third parties and sucks up huge amounts of information. I mean, there was this point at which, even while everybody was flipping out about what Edward Snowden told us about the NSA collecting information, the DEA had embedded people at the phone companies and was sucking in all the phone calls that, you know, pretty much everybody in America was making. And so it's all being collected and we don't know anything about it. Yeah. And we need to get on top of that.
Edward Snowden, whether you think he's a traitor or whether he's a good guy who alerted the world to this, says that without encryption, we will lose all privacy. He advocates encryption on all this communication. And, of course, Apple does encrypt communications on their phones that the government would like a backdoor into. What's your stance on encryption?
So, you know, the thing about encryption is it keeps our communication safe. It makes it hard for the government to get access. The government sometimes thinks in serious situations it needs access. But what my friends in the privacy community tell me, and I'm willing to believe because I haven't heard a satisfactory answer out of the government, is when you create that back door, anybody can get in. So here's a scary thought. The NSA itself was hacked, and all of its spy tools were taken by somebody else, by other, you know, entities that were available in other countries. So there's every reason to worry about weakening encryption.
Wow. There's encryption. There is the fact that we are now on the Internet of Things, where we're opening our home to potential hackers, because if we can access the thermostat, so can they. If we have a video doorbell that we can see at the office who's at our front door at home, so can they. What should listeners take away from this conversation in 30 seconds or less? Should we change our relationship to these emerging technologies?
No, there's one answer. There's very one clear answer, which is regulation. We don't want to go back to living in a world 30 years ago, and we can't, and we never will. We just need to get ahead of this world and have rules in place for how it operates.
Barry Friedman is the director of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law, and he's also the author of Unwarranted Policing Without Permission, and another book, too, The Will of the People. Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.